On behalf of the Interstate and Technology Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC Vapor Intrusion Mitigation Session 1. My name is Devin Sechkar. I am your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online technical resources for vapor intrusion mitigation produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Let's go over some housekeeping rules for today. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through CLUIN for those not able to join us live. The CLUIN training page offers the slides for you to download under Download Training Materials. Use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical problems at any time during the session. We will have a question and answer break halfway through the training, as well as at the end of the modules today. For those of you that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form at the end of the training. Once you complete the form and click the box that you certify you participated, a certificate will be provided to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be part of ITRC, please visit ITRC's website. On our website, you can register for teams and learn how to, you can be an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the materials nor endorse any specific products. On slide 4, I have the pleasure of introducing our trainers today. All of them served as members of the VIM team and volunteered to support the training offered today. The first trainer is incorrect, actually, and my apologies, Matt, for that. The first trainer is Matt Williams from the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. He will begin the training for us today. Matt,
thank you, Devin. Thank you, Devin. As we're switching over here to the control, like Devin said, I'm not Kelly Johnson. I'm Matt Williams from Michigan, from the Remediation Redevelopment Division of the Environmental Great Lakes and Energy. We're here today to talk about a great product. We're going to go through today's training topics. We're actually going to cover 4 of the different modules today. Conceptual site models for vapor intrusion mitigation, public outreach that you do during vapor intrusion mitigation, what steps and information you may be able to provide during rapid response and ventilation, and some of the outreach materials that are there, as well as the remediation and institutional controls for vapor intrusion mitigation and those outreach materials. What we're hoping that you learn as we go through today's section is the background on the vapor intrusion mitigation training team. We're going to go through an overview of the available documentation and information that's out there and how you can access the mitigation strategies and the information. We're going to go through and we're going to identify what sections will be discussed in today's section and also identify what is available in session number 2. What is not covered in today's training is emergency response actions. And these are things where you would immediately contact first responders. And this happens when we have typically reports of strong petroleum odors or there's evidence of combustible, explosive, or oxygen deficient conditions. At those times, you should immediately contact the fire department or go through the appropriate steps that you have for your state. Another situation that is not covered as part of this training today is methane mitigation or hazardous substances that have a high explosive potential, as well as radon. And even though a lot of these strategies would be valid for these, because of the unique contaminants and the different situations, there is some differences that you should account for if you have those different scenarios that you're trying to address as well. The emergency tech Technologies outreach materials is a section that we're going to go through today that it's going to capture technologies and strategies that are not exclusively or mitigation or remediation. And this was kind of a group of technologies that when we show you the flowchart that's available, and mainly the one that's in there right now is the aerobic vapor migration barriers, or AVMBs. And what these do is they create an aerobic bio barrier for petroleum vapors. It's very unique, and it happens for petroleum and not used on chlorinated sites. But this section, and when we go through and we identify where it's at for you, is a placeholder for the inclusion of other emerging technologies that may not fall in one of our more traditional buckets. This vapor intrusion mitigation training team is based on two previous documents that ITRC put out. In January 2007, they put out the Vapor Intrusion Pathway, a practical guideline, which addressed vapor intrusion in general and addressed chlorinated as well as petroleum vapor intrusion as one. When the team reconvened in October in 2014, what we did is we broke off and looked specifically more at petroleum vapor intrusion, which is a specific subset of vapor intrusion. And the vapor intrusion mitigation team went off of these two documents because there was multiple requests and for additional details and training on mitigation. So these two documents focused mainly on the investigation phase. And this one then deals with if you've identified it as being either a potential or a documented condition in the structure, is how do we mitigate these structures. So we wanted to back things up a little bit and start with, what is vapor intrusion? So vapor intrusion is when we have contaminants or hazardous substances, some places call it, in the soil and groundwater that can volatilize into vapor or soil gas. And vapor intrusion occurs when these vapors migrate through the soil upward into overlying buildings and contaminate indoor air. And then if the concentrations are present at significantly high concentrations, those vapors may pose a threat to the occupants and pose an unacceptable risk. There are two different types of vapor intrusion, and this is what the previous documents talked about. One is chlorinated vapor intrusion, or CVI, which addresses chlorinated compounds and mixed releases. And the other one is petroleum vapor intrusion, which deals with a subset of vapor intrusion exclusively with petroleum hydrocarbons, or PHCs. The links again to those two resource documents you can see beneath the figures, and we welcome you to check those out because they do provide a lot of valuable information and background, especially if you're investigating in the investigation stage. So vapor intrusion mitigation is implemented to reduce indoor air contaminant levels to below applicable actions or screening levels, depending on how your regulatory agency views them. It's accomplished by modifying the vapor intrusion pathway to reduce the mass flux of contaminants that enter the building. And the end result is by reducing the indoor air contaminant concentrations. Usually the technologies involve either removal, rerouting the contaminants around the structure, or in some cases, dilution. So what is vapor mitigation, or in some places, vapor control? Vapor control can include a number of things. One is source remediation, and you can see it's highlighted, and that's basically where you're addressing the contaminant before it gets to the structure. There is active and passive mitigation is a form of VOC, or vapor control, in which you modify the slab or where the vapors enter the structure. And those tend to be two different types, and we'll get into both of those in session two. There's rapid response, and we'll talk about that today. And those are typically activities that you do immediately upon finding or identifying vapor intrusion is occurring. And finally, there's institutional controls. And those are done as kind of the wrap up or along the process to identify in states that use institutional controls a means to make sure that people understand what things need to be done to keep the property safe into the future. There are three different main groups that involve several steps in the vapor intrusion mitigation process. The first one is the pre-system installation, and it involves three different things, including the assessment of site conditions, the technology selection, and the development and document of the system design. The assessment of site conditions, again, is what the other documents focused on. And this document, the vapor intrusion mitigation, really focuses on the technology selection, the development, the system design, and then goes on to the system installation, where it talks about things that you need to do, like the pre-construction meeting and the actual installation and installation oversight. And finally, after you've installed the system, the final group of things to look at is the post-installation. And that involves the system verification to make sure that the system's working, where we confirm the performance QAQC, we verify typically through sampling and inspection that the system's working. We also put together the documentation of the system that documents that how the system was installed, as well as how the system, the final system and the specs that we used to make the system work. And then it moves into an operation, maintenance, and monitoring phase that keeps the system running effectively. When equipment breaks down, it establishes parameters to get back and repair the system. This is the ITRC vapor intrusion mitigation webpage. It's a roadmap that's available. There's also a link that you can go on the bottom of your page and click on it. It's an interactive directory that'll take you directly to the different sections, where you will find a combination of different fact sheets, technology information sheets, flow charts, as well as the consideration and impacts of various vapor intrusion mitigation approaches. The checklists that are there, you can see, will help you where you can either incorporate it as part of your process or use them as they are. There's additional information that's available in each of these sections, and we encourage you to check and use and click around on the site. Wanted to take a second and kind of show you the way that this is set up. So to begin things, we're going to show you a process fact sheet. Because on these process fact sheets, and you can see these in the design considerations, post-installation, and the operation, maintenance, and monitoring fact sheets, these will take you to a website which presents categories, the principal considerations, and the subject matter. But then it also shows the active approaches, the mitigation type that's out there, and how relevant that information is to the system design. And you can see that through a system of Harvey balls, kind of like the consumer energy reports, where you can see if it's got a high impact, a medium impact, or possibly low impact or not applicable. And so this will kind of guide you through that process. From there, you're able to take that the process fact sheet narrative, and you'll be able to read further about why that information is important. And you can look at it compared to what type of mitigation system you're looking at. And so this will allow you to guide through the different processes. Again, these fact sheets are out there for you to go through, but it provides additional information as well as clickable links to help you obtain the information you need for the design process. There are various checklists that you'll be able to come across. You can see the one here, or an example of the part of the conceptual site models, which is available just by clicking on the fact sheet button. It has, if you wish to use it as ITRC has presented it for it, it has a series of clickable boxes. It also has editable fields that allows you to fill the information out. And again, it's set up where we start things out with a category so you understand kind of where you're at. It provides primary prompts that kind of get you the more of the detailed information, as well as prompts to record the supporting information for you. So these are different tools and resources that are part of the vapor intrusion mitigation team. Forgot to talk about the secondary prompts. So if there were other information or more detailed information that the team thought was necessary, you'll find these in these secondary prompts. And again, you'll be able to click on it or have editable fields to make your response. So coming up next, we're going to start things off. And again, we've got four different units that we're going to talk about today. The next one that we're going to talk about is conceptual site models for vapor intrusion mitigation. And I'm going to turn it over to Dave Folks from GeoSyntech and Laurent Levy from Jacobs.
Great. Thanks a lot, Matt. Appreciate that. And hello, everyone. Welcome to our first module of the vapor intrusion mitigation training session on conceptual site models. Sorry about that. Delayed reaction. So what we're going to talk about today and our objectives of this module are to first to say what a vapor intrusion mitigation CSM is and why it's important, And we'll also talk about the kind of information that you might want to have to develop a mitigation CSM. And then finally, how to use that in the evaluation of your mitigation options. So, what is a mitigation CSM? I expect that nearly all of you, if not all of you, are familiar with a vapor intrusion CSM, which describes the vapor intrusion pathway from the source of the vapors, such as dissolved base plume here, or perhaps some LNAPL on the water table, the diffusion pathway, entry into a building, and then the receptors that might be impacted. So that's the CSM that tells us whether we have a VI problem or not. Now, when you think about it, if we do have a problem and we're trying to mitigate it, what we're really needing to do is somehow alter this pathway so it doesn't have the same end result. A mitigation grade CSM, which is really what we mean by a mitigation CSM, has sufficient information about the pathway to let us do that. So Matt already went over this, but just to reemphasize, when we're trying to mitigate the VI pathway, we can do that at various points along the pathway, starting with the source. And you know, that's frequently something we have to do for the final remedy anyways, whether it's the only thing that we would need to do for vapor intrusion depends on how quickly we can do it. But most of the time, as I think most of you realize, we often need some interim measure, interim action to control the entry of the vapors into the building. And common way is various subslab controls like subslab depressurization. If we already have vapors inside the building, then we might use indoor air treatment or ventilation for a rapid response, and we'll talk about in modules later on. Or HVAC modification that could actually be part of our longer term remedy to either ventilate or keep VOCs out through positive pressure. And then kind of the last part of our pathway, the building itself, institutional controls may be necessary to prevent certain uses like residential use, or to make sure that our mitigation systems are actually being operated until the source is cleaned up. But really the take home message here is that when we're mitigating, we're trying to modify some portion of the VI pathway. And if you think about it that way, you're more likely to understand what's going on and to understand why it's working or not working during performance evaluations. So let me shift to talk a little bit about the type of information you might need to have what we call a mitigation CSM or a mitigation grade CSM. In this example, I'm just looking at the possible use of an active or passive building control like subslab depressurization. Is that going to be what we want to use or not at this site? The kind of information that will help you decide that you may not have with your initial CSM would be subslab VOC concentrations. Are they low enough that passive approaches might work, or are they so high that you might have diffusion through the concrete slab, in which case you would have to do more than just subslab controls? Do soil and moisture conditions, are they going to be suitable for moving air under the slab for ventilation or extension of your vacuum radius of influence? Slab integrity, if you have a leaky slab, then that can certainly give you lots of makeup air for ventilation, but it could limit the radius of influence of your system. And One thing we often don't have for older buildings is information on subslab features like stem walls or grade beams or other things that might interrupt subslab operation. If you can get that information, it's really helpful. And just as one more example, we talked a lot in the last few years about preferential pathways and their importance for some buildings. And when we talk about preferential pathways, what we usually mean is an advective pathway, like an open conduit between the vapor source and the building. And what that does is it short circuits the diffusion pathway that limits the rate of VOC transport. So in many cases, if you have this condition, it can really dominate the mass flux of VOCs into your building and maybe the principal thing you need to control. So if that's the case, you need to know it's there and you need to know enough about it so that you can mitigate it. So it needs to be in your CSM. And I just to give you some more examples about the importance and how we'd use a mitigation CSM, I want to just look at a large building, which really isn't any different from a small building, except we have more variable conditions. And if you will, perhaps multiple mitigation CSMs in different parts of the building. In this example, we've got both the dissolved phased groundwater plume and also some solvents below the floor, which may have been due to a vapor degreaser release in the past. And note that we got some contaminated groundwater in the storm sewer that connects to the building by drainings. Of course, these different sources are going to transport differently in different situations, and we have diffusion control pathways from the groundwater and from the solvent, perhaps through the floor. But we have advective control pathways through the pipes, the floor drain and the storm drain that we want to consider. And the kind of building information that's really useful for mitigation purposes is the integrity of the building shell. And in this example, the original building on the right is leaky. Wind blows through cracks in the walls. And the shell in the new addition is tight. Similarly, we have degraded concrete in the old part and good concrete and a nice permeable gravel in the new part of the building. So all of that information helps us evaluate the different options we have for control. And just to kind of run through that, looking at rapid response options and even longer term HVAC options, we might be able to apply positive pressure to the new building, but have a little trouble with the leaky side, but maybe we can ventilate that better. And of course, we want to seal those preferential pathways we know about. From a building slab control standpoint, the new building is ideal with its intact concrete and gravel. We could potentially even make a passive system work. Whereas the old building, a little more challenging. We don't have a nice gravel layer. We got degraded concrete. Tells us you might have to seal that floor because of diffusion issues. And on the other hand, maybe we can use subslab piping and even permeable backfill areas to help extend our vacuum field and make an active system more efficient. And then from a longer term final remedy standpoint, the groundwater plume will probably need treatment while these controls are doing their job. We might want to remove this source more aggressively using SVE, or you perhaps wait till building demolition and then excavate it out if there's anything left to deal with at that time. And then finally, use restrictions. You might want to prevent residential use of a building in this situation, or have controls or administrative controls that require operation of these systems while the building is in use. And with that, I'm going to turn things over to Laurent, which will talk to you a bit more about how to collect this information. And take it away, Laurent.
Thank you, Dave. So let's continue with a knowledge check. And a question is, what is a component of the mitigation CSM? Is it the contaminant type? Is it the distance between a VOC source and a building? Is it the location and depths of sanitary sewers? Is it the condition of the building slab? Would we say all of the above, or is it none of the above? So we'll give a few seconds for the attendants to respond. All right, I think we can close the poll and check the results. So looks like everyone answered right. I do not have control of the slides. Can I have control? All right, perfect. I got it. So the answer was all of the above. And of course, because we know that the CSM is a conceptual description of the entire pathway that's occurring at the building of interest from the source to the receptor. As Dave alluded to, the mitigation CSM can have a lot of detail. And one tool to help organize site information and select possible mitigation approach is the flowchart that you can see on your screen. And you can find this flowchart in the CSM fact sheet on the ITRC VI mitigation website. So don't try to read this chart yet. We'll walk through an example. The flowchart captures the three key elements of the CSM in one diagram: the source, the transport, and the receptor. And as you can see, the source part of the diagram is at the bottom, and the receptor part is at the top to mirror vapor intrusion occurring from the subsurface into the building indoor air and the occupants. And to see how this flowchart works, let's focus on a portion of the diagram. As you can see, there are sets of boxes which represent different components of the CSM linked with a set of arrows and valves. So let's do an example. Let's assume our CSM indicates that VI is occurring from groundwater. The VOCs dissolved in groundwater volatilize, and they migrate upward by diffusion in soil gas within the vadose zone. And then these VOCs enter the building via either concrete diffusion or advection through cracks, or a combination of both. So in the diagram, we checked all the corresponding boxes on the chart, and we highlighted the arrows corresponding to this particular migration pathway. And as you can see, you also have valves. Each of these valves represent a mean of cutting off the VI pathway. So for instance, consider valve P right here. Well, we could close this valve and stop vapor entry into the building by implementing one of the subslab vapor controls that's shown right on the right side. And as you can see, these include, let me push the photo here. These include vapor barriers, subslab depressurization, or subslab ventilation. And we'll hear more about those technologies in the active and passive mitigation module. We can do another example. Instead of the valve P, we could close valve M right here. And this time you'd be cutting off the soil gas upward migration. And this could be achieved by vapor extraction, a removal shown right to the right here. Like you could use soil vapor extraction, you could use biodegradation, or you could use biovanting. And these will be discussed in the remediation module today. So this flow chart, in summary, can help you determine on the basis of the CSM for a particular building, what mitigation or remediation options are available in your toolbox to address vapor intrusion. And again, you can find this flow chart in the CSM fact sheet. Another tool to help develop the mitigation CSM is the checklist. And this document is also available on the ITRC VI mitigation website. And so the purpose of this checklist is to help guide mitigation planning. It highlights important factors that should be considered for different elements of the VI pathway. This checklist assumes that VI characterization has been completed and it's been determined that VI mitigation is necessary at a building. The checklist can help further identify key consideration of the CSM relating to VI mitigation. And it can also help support your evaluation of mitigation alternatives. So in this checklist, you will find the mitigation goals at the beginning. This helps the user focus on site features that are relevant to development of a mitigation to meet those goals. The next sections of the checklist follow the same organization as the flow chart on the previous slide, of course, so source, transport, and receptor. And the users can fill in the sections that are appropriate to their situation. So for instance, if source remediation is your goal, then the building details may not be very important. And by contrast, If building mitigation is the goal, then the buildings section shown right here on the checklist should be completed to help verify that key information has been collected. All right, time for another knowledge check. So I see we've opened the polls and the question is, when is it important to verify and update the mitigation CSM? Is it during mitigation design and planning? Is it at the time of mitigation implementation? Is it during long-term management? Is it all of the above or never? So let's give a few seconds. 3, 2, 1. I think we can close the poll and do a check. And it looks like more or less everyone answered correctly. The answer was all of the above. And of course, this is perhaps one of the most important lessons of this module. The CSM is not something that is developed at the time of mitigation design and then forgotten about. It needs to be continuously reevaluated throughout the life cycle of the project. Here are a few additional resources for consideration. So I realize Matt touched upon these earlier, but first the ITRC guidance from 2007 to your left. In the middle, the ITRC VI guidance from 2014, also called PVI guidance. In this guidance, if you check, includes a Petroleum VI CSM checklist in Appendix D. You'll find that. It's pretty elaborate. And finally, the CSM for mitigation fact sheet on the ITRC website. So in summary, there are three key things to remember from the CSM module. First, the VI CSM that you developed during site characterization should continue to evolve as your plans for mitigation are developed and you move mitigation towards long-term operations. Second, consider using the flowchart and the checklist in support of your CSM. And these are tools that can help you determine the specific VI pathways relevant to the building to mitigate. And they can also help identify options for successful vapor control strategies. One note though, these tools address relatively common scenarios. They may not include every possibility, but they can help you think through VI mitigation in a more systematic way. And finally, the VI mitigation CSM can also support public outreach. So it can help you explain the mitigation approach, frame some key aspects, and describe how and why mitigation should work. So this concludes the CSM module. I am now turning over to Susan McKinley at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, who is going to tell you more about public outreach during VI mitigation. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the ITRC Public Outreach During Vapor Intrusion Mitigation module. There we go. After completing this module, we hope you will understand that public outreach from vapor mitigation can be different from other types of environmental outreach. There are a number of great risk and public outreach documents that are available. So for our document, we tried to focus on how public outreach may be different for vapor intrusion and vapor mitigation projects. We hope you understand that outreach is necessary before mitigation and continues throughout the project into long-term management and the exit strategy. We have our own fact sheet, but we also have a small section in each of the vapor mitigation fact sheets to emphasize this. And finally, public outreach requires diverse approaches and must be repeated in a variety of ways, and it's everyone's job. Let's talk about some of the ways that vapor intrusion outreach may be different. One of the first big differences is that the bulk of investigations takes place inside. You're not drilling a hole in the yard. You're drilling a hole in a place where people work or live. It's intrusive, which needs to be discussed in conversations with affected individuals. Completing mitigation and continued long-term stewardship depends on continued access to the inside of people's homes and workplaces. Recognize that what you're asking is a big deal, so it's important to build a relationship. Vapor intrusion is also generally more unfamiliar to most people than other environmental issues. VI is relatively new and hasn't gotten the press that many other environmental issues have gotten. You're likely going to have to explain things a little bit more to help people understand what is happening. Most important, it's about the air that we breathe, which can cause a lot of added anxiety. For example, we have a choice about whether or not to turn the tap on. We cannot choose to not breathe. This additional loss of control can cause a lot of added anxiety. While we can't tell people how to feel, we need to understand the added anxiety when we have conversations with them. So be proactive in your communication to help people feel as comfortable as possible. Another thing to think about is that vapor mitigation involves permanent building modifications, holes in the floor, pipes running up the structure, a fan that will run continuously, maybe for a very long time. We've included a matrix of the concerns and other topics in our document as a resource for you to know what to expect. Let's talk a little bit about the comprehensive nature of vapor mitigation outreach and some key components. As with all projects, outreach needs to be considered early and often. Public outreach is often an afterthought, but that's not a good strategy. Transparency is important. Since it's so unfamiliar to most people, occupants and owners will need a larger amount of information for VI work than for other environmental work. Transparency builds trust, so when additional questions arise, the answers can be given from a reputable source, and that source will hopefully be you. Relationships need to be maintained to ensure continued access and cooperation. Routine communications in informal settings, for example, kitchen table conversations, may be needed to maintain those relationships so that you can have continued access. Depending on the community, partners or intermediaries may be needed to assist with translating and gaining trust and access. And this might be especially important in environmental justice communities where owners and occupants may not have the time or the resources to be educated on environmental issues, or they may not feel empowered to ask questions. It's important to make sure that they understand what is happening and that the mitigation project addresses their needs. Above all, listen. Listening to the concerns of the building owners and occupants is a key part of the communication process. While our document attempts to help you prepare for what concerns might be, it's not a substitute for determining what people on your site care about. Communicating vapor intrusion is complicated. Unfamiliar words. Intrusion, mitigation, pressure field extension. These are not words that people are familiar with, and it may take them longer to process information. You may need to spend more time communicating with owners and occupants, and you're definitely going to want to leave something with them so they know how to ask questions that they think of later. And it's not just the words. Vapor has many things to measure and compare. Many of the things we measure won't cause human health issues. They're triggers to look at indoor air. For example, subslab, soil gas, or maybe your state uses groundwater screening levels to trigger vapor investigations. Affected parties can look at a publicly available screening level table and see they're above a subslab number, but they likely wouldn't consider that they're not breathing that air. It's key to incorporate explanations of all the different samples, preferably from the beginning. Variability can be orders of magnitude. Typically, the data is variable both spatially and temporally. Interpreting it is challenging even for environmental professionals, so communicating a clear message is necessary. Background contributions from common consumer products can also muddy the waters. It's complicated to explain an elevated concentration related to a background source. It's important to clarify that we don't regulate these sources and defer to the local health departments. While at the VI mitigation stage, we're generally past this part of the confrontations, but it's important to emphasize that potential confusion and frustration during the vapor investigation phase can carry forward into the mitigation phase if not adequately addressed. Also, communicating about vapor mitigation is complicated. So try to use analogies. You can maybe tell people that we're going to install a fan that forms an invisible pressure barrier beneath their building to protect them. That probably won't be helpful. Many people are familiar with radon mitigation, or they've at least heard of it. We've listed also some states' guidance in the document as a resource for you. Many of them are aimed at the public and explain systems in a way that is helpful. And finally, partner up. Rely on specialized Department of Health staff or doctors for health communication. As the document points out, it's important to include people like local health officials and others in your outreach plan so that they are available if questions arise. As you move through the VI investigation into mitigation, the questions will become less about the mechanics of vapor intrusion and more about logistics and property values. People may worry that their schedule or their time may be disrupted. What's my electric bill? How loud will this be? Who is going to pay for this? The document incorporates possible concerns into a matrix. A simple fact sheet may help address many of these questions. Others can be addressed by simply being responsive. For example, maybe you can hide that ugly pipe with a false chimney if that's important to your homeowner. Regardless of the concerns, they are important to the building owners and occupants and must be addressed. This maintains the trust and cooperation that you've hopefully already established. As your project progresses, you might have repeated conversations with the same party as the nature of questions changes. Remember to emphasize that the reason for the mitigation is to protect people's health. Use multiple methods of communication. Group settings and one-on-one discussions both have a place. Remember, mitigation-specific questions will arise that people might not have had the wherewithal to think of during the initial outreach when concerns about health were high and everything was unfamiliar. So leaving a fact sheet with contact info, as I said earlier, is a great idea. Social media and dedicated internet sites are also great resources to reach people. Finally, we need to realize that communication is everyone's job. Vapor mitigation projects have a lot of moving parts and a lot of people involved. Every interaction matters and perception matters. Consider that mitigation field personnel and designers will be interacting with people in their houses, and they are not trained communicators, so help them out if you can. Every stakeholder plays a role in communication. Also, be mindful of situations where the occupant is not the owner. The resident might not have all the information given to the owner, or vice versa. It's the consultant's responsibility to inform the mitigator and field personnel what can be shared while at the property and who to direct occupants to for additional information. This coordination needs to take place in advance of mobilizing to the site. Long-term management is a key part of mitigation success. You want to make sure your system continues to work. We can't simply hand over a manual to the owner or occupant and hope for the best. Different states will have different methods of addressing long-term management, and it may not always be the responsible party. So you'll need a plan communicating how to address system issues, changes to the structures, or changes of institutional or engineering controls at property transfers. One of the best ways to encourage longevity of critical information is to tie it to the system, just physically strap it right on there, labeling it with contact information on a sticker, tie the manual to the system, include the closure letter and or a copy of the administrative controls that clarify responsibility for the long-term operation and maintenance of the system. And you'll also want to retain a copy in case that is lost or misplaced. I think we've arrived at our knowledge check. When is it important to do public outreach? During VI investigation, during mitigation design and planning, at the time of mitigation implementation, during long-term management, or all of the above? I think we can close the poll. Excellent. The correct answer is all of the above. As stated at the beginning of the module, public outreach needs to begin at the vapor intrusion investigation phase. And although that's not a focus of the fact sheet, it's an important point to remember. The next three bullets are things we talked about today, with the reason and the focus of outreach may change as the project progresses. The need is continual. This includes making sure that the right people are educated and engaged in the long-term management of your system. The system isn't maintained because of inadequate communication on the management plan. There's really no point in installing it in the first place. Here's some additional resources. As stated at the beginning, public outreach has a separate fact sheet, and here's a little picture of it. In the middle is the petroleum VI guidance, which you've pointed out a couple of times, but it does have a really detailed section on community engagement. And additionally, ITRC has published a rich communication toolkit in June 2020. It's a great resource that dives deep into the complexities and strategies for successfully communicating with the public on health risk from environmental contamination. The risk communication toolkit is not specific to vapor intrusion, but it's directly applicable. There's a couple of other resources in our fact sheet, for example, the FDA plain language principles. Now, I think I send it back to the moderator for a question and answer break.
Yes, Susan, this is Matt. I'll take it. I'll go back and ask some of the questions that we've been getting in over the next 10 minutes here. We've got some great questions in the queue. First one, I'm going to reach out to Dave and Laurent that says, one of the questions we got in is a sewer pipe a relevant pathway if the pipe contains a water trap preventing sewer gases from entering the building? Dave, Laurent?
Yeah, I'll I guess in the first instance, if the source of the vapor is just the contents of the sewer, then in a sense that wouldn't be soil vapor intrusion, but a very similar process. But sometimes contaminants in the groundwater can get into a sewer and then get into a building via the pipe, and that would be a vapor intrusion preferential pathway. If there is a P trap and it has water, of course, that's the purpose of the P trap, to help prevent those vapors from coming in. Sometimes that water evaporates if the feature isn't used for a long period of time. And there's other ways that vapors can get in through leaking couplings that might be in the crawl space or something like that. Laurent, you have thoughts?
Yeah, I responded on the chat, and I added plumbing fixtures, which you pointed to, like toilet seats that are not properly sealed, up and clean out drains in the basement and so forth. So, and I provided a link to the GSI information on sewer preferential pathways.
Well, one thing I think I wanted to add, and this is Matt, to it, and I think that's one of the things that we've been seeing on some of our sites recently, is we're actually kind of shocked at the number of P traps that aren't working on some of our sites, where we're going through and doing the analysis and trying to figure out, even though they're supposed to have water, we've even had a couple state buildings where the traps weren't functioning for whatever reason. So just because it has a trap doesn't mean it's necessarily functioning correctly either. So it might be something that you have to check out.
One thing I wanted to add is Wisconsin is a state that has developed specific VI guidance for addressing sewer. And I'll place a link to the guidance manual. But that's very rare to see a whole document dedicated just to those sewer pathways. And some states are starting to adopt attenuation factors. I think it's 0.03. I believe Indiana and Wisconsin have used an attenuation factor of 0.03 between the sewer gas concentration and to make a prediction of what to expect in indoor air. And this is, again, based on the GSI study of sewer gas that was completed a few years ago, where 0.03 seems to be an upper end number for an attenuation factor from sewer gas to indoor air.
Okay, I'm going to send this one to Susan. Do you recommend a state health official take the lead in discussing indoor air results? Residential indoor air will have contaminants not related to the source. Self-contamination is a non-trivial component of risks. Or do you recommend not analyzing for contaminants other than the source?
That is a great question, and it has several parts. I'll kind of take them one by one. The state health official taking the lead, it depends on the questions. We have risk, and also how your agency is structured. We have risk assessors that can explain pretty well what a screening level means. But if a resident has questions about how it's going to actually affect their health, then we would refer them to the professional, because we don't have a toxicologist or a doctor. I just lost the question. What was the second part of that? I'm not seeing the question now.
Oh, I'm sorry. I moved it over as you were answering it.
Okay. What was the second part of it?
Hold on one second. It is, do you recommend not analyzing for contaminants other than the source? So you're from Indiana, right?
Right.
Does Indiana recommend right. that?
Specifically, we recommend whatever chemistry recommends, which in the first blush is going to be the VOCs and the standard method. And then as the site progresses, we would probably let you cut down and only measure the things of interest. We're big on lines of evidence. Most of the things that show up that aren't chlorinated, you can explain. So we would request lines of evidence, and if it was something that you firmly believe was an indoor air source, then we'd probably want you to find it and remove it from the building and retest and make sure that it still wasn't there. So did that answer your question, you think?
Yep. I think we, if not, we will see something in the queue again.
Okay.
I think I'm going to send this around to the group because we're all from different, we're all familiar with different state agencies. And I think this is going to be a little bit different of an answer for everybody. But are the homeowners financially responsible for the mitigation technologies? And again, I think that most states are going to have a different answer, but we can go around quick. Do they pay a monthly cost associated with continued operation? So I think let's start with Dave. Because you work in a lot of states, right?
Yeah. Well, in the sites I've worked on, if there is a responsible party, they typically will pay for the electrical costs and do O&M and all of that kind of thing. In some cases where it's an orphan site and the state may pay for the installation of a system, the building owner then might be responsible for maintaining it. That would depend on the individual circumstance.
Lauren, would you like to add anything to that?
No, that's a great answer.
Okay. Merrick, I'll reach out to you too. We haven't heard from Merrick yet, but he'll be having a speaking part this afternoon. You work in quite a few different states too as well.
Yes, I have the same experience. However, in my experience, vast majority of cases, either the state, either the PRP or the state pays for the cost. It's rare that the homeowner does.
Okay. Let's see here. I think I'm going to push this question to Dave because I know some of your background a little bit. And what is the difference between active versus passive ventilation? Using fans? And positive pressure, how do you install such a thing without noise control? And before I pass it to Dave, I'll say this is one of the things that we'll talk about in our vapor and mitigation training too. But if you could give a brief answer about the differences between active and passive, that'd be awesome.
Well, typically what we mean in the field is that an active system has some kind of electrical component, typically a fan, to move the air, whereas a passive system relies on Mother Nature, thermal gradients, pressure gradients induced by wind and other things to move air below a slab and possibly create a bit of a vacuum. There's some differences of opinion whether a system that has a wind turbine or a wind-driven fan, excuse me, is active or passive. That'll kind of depend on your state. And where that can become important is it might trigger air permit requirements if it's considered to be an active system. And that, you know, I'm talking about subslab systems in terms of positive building control. If that was part of the question, that would be an active system. And from the noise standpoint, most radon fans that we use for smaller buildings anyways are designed to be fairly low noise. There's techniques to install them and places to install them to keep the noise down. But it's something you have to be careful of when you're designing a system. You don't want to put it right outside of a bedroom window. And also the size of the pipe can affect the noise of air moving through it. So if you have a big fan pulling a lot of air, you want a fat pipe, not a skinny pipe, because it'll be noisy and if it's skinny and lose a lot of vacuum at the same time.
Okay. I'll open this one up to the group. Other than sewer, any other utility corridors have similar level of concern for preferential pathways for vapor intrusion, such as water lines? The writer wonders why only sewer lines are mentioned most of the time. So Lauren or Eric, you'd be interested in taking the first run at that?
I can give a shot. And Eric, by all means, please add anything you have. Sewer tends to be the focus because sewer may intercept the groundwater table and be leaky. And so you have groundwater infiltrating in those lines and off-gassing vapors. And those vapors can travel quite far away and can travel beyond the sort of 100 feet radius that's often common for assessing building above a plume. So some research has shown that if you take the sewer pathways, it might be beyond 100 feet of your groundwater plume, and you would have to investigate buildings that are tied to this. You don't really see this for water lines. For one thing, those water lines tend to be pressurized, so you're not going to have the vapors. You may consider sort of the fill material that's around the piping. But in general, and I can point you to the research has shown that you don't really see this beyond 100 feet. So if your building is already within 100 feet of your plume, you're already looking at this building, and you're not going to have this case of vapors moving along the annular space of your utility beyond 100 feet. That's the research, again, of the GSI team that has looked into this. And I'm happy to post the research on this.
So Eric?
Yeah, I would just add, I think at a high level, there's a couple different concepts. So there's the concept of some sort of, impacted sewer gas that is traveling through the conduit itself or the backfill and making its way into the building. But something that I'll touch on in the next section, which is on rapid response, is where that conduit passes through the building envelope, whether it's a sewer line, a water line, a gas line, how well the slab is sealed to that conduit is important and can be the source of a preferential pathway. So that's another thing to consider.
Thanks, Eric and Laurent. We're kind of out of time here. We've got some other great questions that we'll get to. I do want to put a general shout out that says some of your questions, we may be referring you to the vapor intrusion mitigation session number 2, because we're going to talk specifically about different mitigation strategies, active, passive, and remedial technologies. So you may get a note from us just to indicate on some of these so that we try to get through them all to tune in for that, because your question is going to be answered during that. So with that, Devin, if we could turn it over to Eric Blodgett from BAR to continue on.
Eric, ready when you are.
Thanks, Devin.
Just trying to advance the slide here. There we go. Okay, so coming back in from the Q&A, all good questions. We're going to jump into rapid response for vapor intrusion mitigation. So, watching this module, you should really come away with 3 key ideas. First, what is a rapid response and how does it differ from a long-term vapor intrusion mitigation strategy? Second, you should be able to recognize the conditions under which a rapid response is appropriate. And then third, you should be familiar with the administrative and engineering controls that are available. And these include preferential pathway sealing and ad hoc ventilation, indoor air treatment, and HVAC modification. Oops. So what is rapid response? Rapid response is an interim vapor intrusion mitigation approach that might be appropriate under certain conditions, such as when there are very high contaminant concentrations present or when there are sensitive populations present. And this is implemented prior to a long-term mitigation strategy. And for the purposes of this presentation, we've defined a rapid response as one that could easily be implemented and verified on a timescale of days to weeks. And so the main purpose of a rapid response is to address acute risk. Most on the call might be familiar with trichloroethylene or TCE. This is a compound that's very commonly seen as presenting an acute risk from exposure through vapor intrusion. Rapid response is considered an interim response because it can be implemented prior to the final mitigation strategy. A long-term mitigation strategy, such as the ones Dave discussed, such as subslab depressurization, these typically take longer to design and implement, but are often more effective in addressing vapor intrusion. Although I would note that in many circumstances, what you do for rapid response, such as crack sealing, for instance, that can carry over to and supplement your long-term approach. The requirement for rapid response can vary significantly between regulatory programs. Both the criteria that trigger the need for a rapid response and what time frame even qualifies as rapid can also vary. And then you'll see in the word cloud on the right-hand side of the slide, the terminology used to describe rapid response can vary, but there's two common factors. One, an acute risk is present, and then two, an interim action is needed before long-term mitigation can be completed. Matt mentioned at the beginning, although this is the rapid response module, we do not address emergency situations. And if an emergency situation is present, first responders should be contacted immediately. So we're going to pull up our first knowledge check here. Question is, which of these scenarios could warrant a rapid response? A, petroleum vapor intrusion has been documented in a vacant gas station. B, high levels of TCE have been detected in subslab soil gas at a maternity clinic. C, TCE levels have been detected slightly above the state vapor intrusion action levels at an occupied commercial building. And then lastly, D, benzene has been detected at high levels in soil gas at a vacant lot planned for future redevelopment. Just give a couple seconds here. I think we can close the poll. And it looks like the majority got the answer correct. It is B. And the reason for that is because TCE is present and there's a sensitive receptor, we have an acute risk and something needs to be done prior to implementing the long-term mitigation strategy. Whoops, did I skip a slide there? There we go. So in addition to the training you're watching now and with the other modules, there's a variety of materials on ITRC's website that are available. For rapid response, these include a fact sheet and three text sheets. So the fact sheet provides an overview of rapid response and a brief description of the administrative and engineering controls. And then the three text sheets provide more detail about the three engineering controls available for rapid response, which I will discuss in the following slides. So Dave and Laurent went through sort of the broad CSM for all mitigation approaches. Long-term mitigation approaches often focus on the building structure, the subslab zone below the structure, and the contaminant source itself sometimes. But rapid responses are focused primarily inside the building and on the building occupants because this is where they tend to play out. So the elements of the CSM that are most important for rapid response are the building occupants, occupants, preferential pathways, and building pressure and air exchange rate. So we've divided rapid responses into two categories, administrative and engineering controls. The first category, administrative controls, include notification. And so this is simply providing building occupants with information. This could be general vapor intrusion 101 style fact sheets. It could also be something more site specific if that information is available. And as Susan mentioned, now is a good time to consider partnering with a local health agency so that you can coordinate notification efforts. Relocation is another administrative control. So this is simply removing occupants from a structure where vapor intrusion is occurring. And although relocation is fairly drastic and not all that common, it might be prudent in specific situations, such as the maternity clinic that we discussed in the knowledge check. But putting a single family home resident up in a hotel often comes to mind with relocation, but in reality, it could just mean moving a group of folks from one area of a large building to another where vapor intrusion is not occurring, or it could mean limiting someone's time in a certain area where vapor intrusion is suspected. So the other category of rapid response is engineering controls. And so engineering controls are physical changes that are made to the building or the way building systems function with the goal of limiting or eliminating occupant exposure to contaminants that are entering the building from vapor intrusion. And this presentation focuses on three technologies that can be implemented rapidly. The first technology is actually two grouped together, preferential pathway sealing and ad hoc ventilation. Preferential pathway sealing involves closing or sealing large openings in the building envelope that allow vapors to enter the building, while ad hoc ventilation involves increasing the air exchange rate within the building by opening windows and doors. Indoor air treatment. This involves deploying an air purifying unit or an APU with the goal of reducing concentrations of contaminants in indoor air quickly. And then lastly, there's HVAC modification. HVAC modification involves changing the way the building is ventilated or pressurized to dilute the concentration of contaminants in indoor air and prevent vapors from entering the building. So the second half of this module, I'll focus on the three engineering control technologies that I just described. And these are preferential pathway sealing and ad hoc ventilation, indoor air treatment, and HVAC modification. And so for each of these, I'll give a brief overview. I'll list the key components, and then I'll provide some additional considerations. But before I get into that, we wanted to do a poll of the audience to get a sense of what rapid responses you may have seen in your experience. So these include A, notification, B, relocation, C, preferential pathway sealing and ad hoc ventilation, D, indoor air treatment, and E, HVAC modification. And we'll just give a couple seconds to finish up the poll, go ahead and close it, see what we got. So this is consistent with the other offerings of this training. We've got a pretty broad range of experience across all of these rapid responses. And it looks like notification and preferential pathway sealing and ad hoc ventilation are the two most common. So when we're thinking about how vapors enter a building and pass through the building envelope, we need to consider two mechanisms, and these are diffusion and advection. Diffusion is the slow process of vapor phase contaminants migrating from areas of high concentration to areas of lower concentration, whereas advection is the transport of vapor phase contaminants by airflow. And so advection is driven by pressure. And as Dave mentioned in the CSM module, this can account for a majority of contaminant flux into a building. And this is especially true when there are large openings or preferential pathways where that flow can occur. The purpose of preferential pathway sealing then is to just directly block those pathways that allow for airflow into the building. These openings can include floor cracks, gaps around utility penetrations or at foundation walls, can include larger openings like sumps and land drains, or just areas where the slab is significantly damaged or deteriorated. Blocking these openings is typically very low cost, can be done quickly, and provides a high rate of return for reducing vapor entry into the building. So ad hoc ventilation doesn't take much to describe. It's basically opening windows and doors with the goal of increasing air exchange, thereby diluting the concentration of contaminants in indoor air. I think fairly obviously the major consideration here is weather. I'm sitting here in Minnesota looking out the window at piles of snow and ice. And so obviously ad hoc ventilation would not be an option for that setting. So one limitation there. Oops. And so this gets to the question that Adam had during the Q&A. So the general components of pathway sealing include caulks and sealants that can be applied to cracks, gaps around utility penetrations. When you're selecting these sealant materials, you have to pay attention to the properties. So is it flexible? Is it non-shrinking? Does it off-gas VOCs that could affect indoor air sampling being conducted nearby? And then also, does the area need to be prepped, cleaned, sanded, have paint removed before applying the sealant? For larger openings like sumps or holes in the slab, you can get off-the-shelf or made-on-the-fly covers. And then for this instance of sewer vapor intrusion, at least when those vapors are within the conduit itself, the diagram in the middle of the slide shows a P-trap. And when that water evaporates or drains out of the P-trap, you no longer have that barrier preventing vapors from moving from the pipe into the building. And so filling this P-trap with water and then verifying that the pipe isn't cracked and the water's leaking out right away, or filling it with vegetable oil for drains that are no longer used or used infrequently because that vegetable oil won't evaporate over time. So next up, we've got indoor air treatment. This is implemented by deploying those air purifying units or APUs inside of a building or in the area of suspected vapor entry. And they work by pulling in air, treating it, and discharging it back into the building. One note though, a limitation on the use of APUs is that they're subject to human interference. So for example, they make noise, they take up space, they have to be plugged in. If a building occupant doesn't want to hear that or deal with it, they may move it or turn it off, obviously limiting how effective it can be. So on the left-hand side, we've got a diagram of a typical absorption ACE-based APU. This one has a carbon, activated carbon filter. And the way this works is untreated air is drawn into the unit by an internal fan. It passes through a series of filters that take out particulates and chemicals of concern. And then the air exits the unit and returns to the indoor airspace. On the right-hand side, you've got a typical picture of a typical APU that's readily available from your favorite online marketplace. Considerations here for indoor air treatment. When you're selecting an APU and when you're sizing it, you have to pay attention to what chemicals you're trying to remove. And this isn't just the chemicals that are entering the indoor air from vapor intrusion. It's also chemicals that might be present because of indoor air sources or other activities that are happening inside the space. The second consideration is size. What is the indoor air volume that you're trying to treat? This is going to define how many and what size APUs that you can use. So lastly, we have HVAC modification. So this is the third and last technology that I'll discuss. And before I walk through HVAC modification, I think it's helpful to remember the phrase air in and air out. This is really the basis for changes that one might make to an HVAC system operation to mitigate vapor intrusion. So first we have fresh air that enters the system and it's distributed through air ducts by a supply air fan. We've got that air shown in blue here. In this scenario, increasing the supply air fan or opening the dampers will increase air in. Next, air from the occupied space of the building is removed by return air ducts. This is shown in green. They lead to a return air fan. The fan exhausts a portion of this air outside, but then it also recycles a portion of it back to the supply fan to be recycled through the building. So here, increasing the return air fan speed or decreasing the recycled air quantity will increase air out. To increase air exchange rate and dilute contaminants in indoor air, we could increase both the supply air and return air fans. And reduce the portion of recycled air. Otherwise, if we wanted to pressurize the building to prevent vapors from entering, we could increase the supply air fan speed to be greater than that of the return air fan. In addition to the main HVAC system itself, a lot of times there are separate exhaust fans, and examples include bath fans, range hoods, fume hoods. Exhaust fans complicate HVAC modification because they increase air out and they act to depressurize the building. So it's important during an interior building survey to identify these fans and consider them when you're making HVAC modifications. And then lastly, in real life, HVAC systems are rarely this simple. And so it's important to enlist facility staff, a licensed HVAC contractor, or mechanical engineer to ensure that HVAC modifications don't inadvertently exacerbate vapor intrusion conditions. And with that, we finished up the rapid response and ventilation section, and I'm going to hand it over to Mark Ostrowski with Brown and Caldwell for remediation and institutional controls.
Thank you, Eric. So this module talks about environmental remediation and institutional controls as they relate to the VI mitigation. Of course, those two are by themselves pretty broad subjects, so we'll be limited to discussing them in the context of VI mitigation. Next slide, please. Okay, thank you. So what we're going to discuss in this module are differences and also similarities between the two, between remediation and mitigation. We'll briefly describe two soil vapor remediation technologies that can also address vapor mitigation. And we'll be talking about the institutional controls, providing a brief introduction. At the end of this module, you should be able to assess the applicability of those things to a particular site. So what are the differences and similarities between remediation and mitigation? I guess at the beginning, it has to be mentioned that there is no clear break line between the two. There is an overlap, and you know, they can address the same things. However, kind of like in the bulk, there are some differences that can be identified, some trends and things like that. So remediation generally is concerned with reduction of mass in the source of the contaminated site, be it soil, groundwater, or free product. It can also include an element of exposure management. However, most of the time, addressing the mass, be it through destruction, removal, or encapsulation, is the main element of the remediation. It also tends to look at the site holistically, site-wide. Of course, there are very small remediation projects, but a lot of them tend to be larger. And because of that, the life cycle of investigation and application is relatively long. I think we're all familiar with environmental projects that you know, have a decade life cycle. On the other hand, mitigation has a very specific purpose, as mentioned before in this presentation, of preventing exposure by breaking the VI pathway. There are large mitigation projects. However, I think most of them, it can be said safely that most of them are building specific. And frequently, VI mitigation is actually regulated to the point where the installation time, application time is relatively short, on the order of weeks, versus remediation, which can be much longer. Mitigation can also provide certain remediation benefits, but it's not its main subject, main objective, and it's relatively negligible. So those were the focusing on the differences, and how can we use the similarities to apply remediation as a method of VI mitigation? So for the VI mitigation, as it was mentioned before throughout this presentation, the hydrocarbons, the chlorinated, are the main target compounds. And they are present in the gas and the vapor in the vadal zone, and thus can enter the buildings, creating a through a pathway. So the mitigation addresses that pathway, whereas remediation can address both the source and the pathway. And certain technologies for applying remediation are applicable here that can accomplish both objectives, and we'll discuss those briefly. That's soil vapor extraction, SVE, and multi-phase extraction, MPE. So, or maybe before we get into that, I guess it has to be mentioned that it may not be the main thrust of this presentation. However, remediation can also affect VI without the intention being there. So in other words, if there is a remediation project nearby, it can either cause a negative effect on VI, increasing it, or it can cause a positive effect on VI. And examples of that would be, let's say, technologies, remediation technologies that create or increase the vapor flow in the subsurface, such as air sparging or thermal, can essentially increase the radius where the VI is happening, and VI may start happening where it wasn't present before. On the other hand, on the positive side, if the VI is caused, for example, by a plume, and there is a remediation project going on at the source of the plume, and that source is either separated, contained, or remediated, the plume will collapse with time, possibly removing the very reason for having VI within the footprint of that former plume. Another consideration is that frequently a remedial process leads to a conclusion that VI mitigation is not enough. You either have to conduct remediation or you have to conduct VI mitigation after the remediation. So those things have to be kept in mind when considering the link between the two. So one of the technologies that can serve as both mitigation and remediation is soil vapor extraction, SVE. And there is a fact sheet on the ITRC website discussing this in more detail. Here, we're just gonna go over very basic things. SVE essentially targets the vadal zone. That's a very important feature of it. It requires a relatively thick vadal zone. It acts by creating a pressure gradient that essentially shunts the soil gas away from the building. And in that case, it acts pretty much the same as a sub-sub depressurization system that will be discussed in session two. And by doing that, intercepts the soil vapors and provides the benefit of VI mitigation. Now, the very important thing to consider here is that soil vapor extraction applied for the remediation reason versus mitigation reason, the two may have very different endpoints. For the remediation, generally the endpoint is achieving certain cleanup goals that as documented by sampling of the soil, whereas for VI mitigation, of course, it's a continuous protection of the building occupants. So one may be achieved by the other, no. So frequently, there has to be an adjustment at some breaking point where remediation has been achieved, but the VI is still going on. So typically, as you see on this slide, the SV system consists of some sort of like extraction facility, like a well, that extracts the soil gas by means of being connected to a low pressure source, such as a blower, or liquid drink pump or something like that. the air generally is pretty highly contaminated that's extracted, so it has to be treated in the treatment system and then discharged into the atmosphere. So the discharge typically has to be permitted. So some of the design considerations for it are, as mentioned before, that it's effective only in the unsaturated zone, and it requires relatively permeable soils. It's not effective in clays, for example. The next technology, which is very similar in its application to VI, is the multi-phase extraction, very similar to SVE. It provides VI mitigation by the same mechanism, namely by intercepting the soil vapors. However, unlike the SVE, it can be also applied to sites where the unsaturated zone is very low. The reason for it is that in addition to extracting soil gas, it also extracts liquids. It can extract groundwater, creating its own drawdown, and thus increasing the extent of the unsaturated zone. Other than that, it's very similar to SVE. It also has to be kept in mind that the end point is maybe very different between the remediation and VI mitigation applications, just like with the SVE. So it has generally has an MPE well, which contains either single or separate facilities for extracting liquid and gas. Then the extracted stream is conveyed into a treatment system where you both treat the air, treat the water, and frequently you have to you recover NAPL, so you have to also get rid of the NAPL off-site. For both of those systems, what has to be kept in mind is that those are applicable as VI mitigation to small sites, because the design and construction cycle for them for large sites is very long. It certainly exceeds the typical time of VI mitigation. So for a single building where you can employ a trailer-mounted system or a repurposed system with very few wells that you can install within weeks, then they're applicable. For the larger sites, they generally are not. So switching gears to the institutional controls, how many of you have been involved with a site that has either a deed restriction or land use control or another device like that, like construction requirements, for example, where health and safety features have to be implemented during construction, building type restrictions, for example, no residential buildings, occupancy, for example, no daycares on the ground floor, requiring a VI mitigation system, restrictions on groundwater use or others. I think we can close the poll now. And yeah, again, the responses are pretty broad. Yeah, institutional controls are very widely applied at VI sites and other sites too. So it looks like most participants had experience with those. We can close the poll. Yeah. Oops. Okay, so what are the institutional controls? Institutional controls are essentially long-term measures that provide both protection from exposure to contaminants and assurance that VI mitigation systems be maintained. And those are legal measures. Those are not technical measures. However, they can be applied either alone or in combination with other remedies like technologies or even engineering controls. And there are four, they can be grouped into four types. And I will use an example of an active VI mitigation system to illustrate the context, how they can be, you know, applied in the context of VI mitigation. So government controls, those are essentially government devices such as zoning ordinances or groundwater use restrictions that are enforced by state or local governments. So they can, as an example, let's say that a town creates a zoning ordinance that says that within this block or this particular part of the town, every new construction has to have an active VI mitigation system. That would be a government control, an example of a government control. The next one is proprietary controls, and those are private agreements between the landowner and an outside party, and they may or may not be involving regulatory agencies, could be between private parties too. And an example of that would be an easement or a covenant. And with our active mitigation system, imagine that the PRP is not the same as the landowner, and the PRP is obligated to construct and maintain an active vapor mitigation system at the site. And they may enter into an easement agreement with the owner that, you know, they will, you know, provide that. However, in exchange, they will have access to the site for maintenance purposes. And then they'll also enter into a covenant with the owner that when the property is transferred, this easement will continue so they can fulfill their legal obligations. So that Merrick, would be an example.
Merrick, I want to jump in and say we're running close. So
okay, I'll be brief then. Enforcement mechanism: a government agency issued permits, such as, for example, administrative orders or consent orders, and informational devices where the existence of VI mitigation feature is recorded in such things as databases or deed notices or informational devices. And that's a poll. Actually, that's a knowledge check. When can you consider, based on what we discussed, when can you consider implementing the ICs? Which one of those? I think we can close the poll. And yes, all of those are essentially great examples of when you can implement the ICs. Okay, we can close that. And there are some resources on the ITRC website for different remediation technologies and different contexts of the remediation, DNAPL, LNAPL, and so on. And with that, I'll pass it on to Matt for another Q&A section.
Thanks, Merrick, and Eric as well. We have quite a few questions in the pod, and so we're going to do our best to answer as many as we can. If we don't get to your question, feel free to reach out to any of the trainers. And like I said, and also please tune in for our session number 2, which will be coming up on January 27th at the same time, 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. So the first question I want to ask here is, give me a second, is for Eric. Eric, does ITRC have any separate additional rapid response mitigation recommendations for addressing short-term TCE risks?
It's a great question. I mean, it's kind of the hot topic when it comes to rapid responses. You know, I'm not aware of anything specifically that ITRC has developed. In my experience, it's going to be an agency by agency or EPA region by EPA region approach when it comes to dealing with concerns, short-term exposure risk for TCE. I think the regulation on it is currently evolving, and so it really just depends on what jurisdiction you're in and how to deal with that. But with that said, I mean, the rapid responses that I talked about in the module, you know, aren't necessarily specific to TCE per se. So any or all of them should be effective to a certain degree with addressing that specific chemical.
Thank you, Eric. We're going to stay with you. Got another one. APU maintenance can also be challenging as the filters have finite capacity. The carbon filter effectiveness on VOCs also decreases as humidity increases. The writer has contacted manufacturers to give better guidance on how to assess when these filters should be changed, but the response is based on time, not necessarily on the loading or estimated breakthrough times. Do you have any clear methodology to assess these filters, specifically carbon filters, and when they should be changed to assure that they continually effectively remove the VOCs from indoor air?
It's a challenge I've run into as well, and I would recommend sidestepping the purifier manufacturer and going directly to the carbon manufacturer if you can, or having custom carbon. When you are able to connect with carbon manufacturers, they typically have uptake factors and models that they use, and they can model the loading based on what your indoor air concentrations are and give you a pretty good estimate of how long that filter life will last.
Okay, thanks. Is anybody else? Is there any other? Sounds like a good answer to me. We'll move on to a question. Dave Folks, can you explain, please explain that ground that has been excavated to install a sewer pipe now becomes a preferential pathway for soil vapor in the ground to lead directly to your home and building. Can you provide some further explanation on that?
Yeah, that's a really good question and point. And what I would like to clarify is that any more permeable zone, whether it's natural or man-made, will potentially be where vapors prefer to go. And that may be the access point, particularly for methane along trenches where you might want to put in a, what we call a trench dam or something to stop that from happening. But I do want to differentiate that from the type of preferential pathway that we are really concerned about, and that's where you have an advective or open conduit pathway, because transport along permeable backfill is still going to be diffusion controlled and still limited by the same rules of vapor intrusion that we deal with in natural geology, meaning that our rules of thumb tend to still work. It's when we have advective flow through a pipe or maybe an open joint in rock that we have what we are starting to call an atypical preferential pathway that requires different type of control.
Merrick, we have a couple questions about SVE for you here. The first one is, how effective is SVE in dense fat clays? And is there anything that can be done to improve vapor recovery?
Yeah, SVE is not effective in low permeability materials such as clay. So that would not be a situation where you would use an SVE system. In other kind of a broader context of remediation, you could do fracturing of a clay layer to improve it, but that's rarely done, and it's not super effective. So I would say when you have a clay layer, then SV would not be effective in it.
And then a different question on SVE, is there a typical rule of thumb for the radius of influence of vertical SVE wells with vadose zone geology consisting of dry sands?
So I guess the short answer is there isn't. Those systems are generally designed by conducting a pilot test to determine that. And what is important is not only what the substrate is, whether it's sand or how permeable, but also what is the type of the ground surface, you know, how is the seal of the ground surface, because that determines the flow pattern. So kind of like a really, really rule of thumb, I would say one well more or less the same as an unsaturated thickness, but that can be, you know, very different if you have, let's say, a building that creates a very good seal on the surface.
Okay, I'll open this one up to the group. The question is about the impact of historical disposal of chlorinated solvents down sewer drains. This has been an issue at dry cleaners. Do you guys see it? And what's a way to address it? So we'll open it up. We'll start with Dave. Do you want to take that one first?
Well, we certainly see it a lot more as an issue of where the source of the vapors has moved to, because the stuff that gets into a sewer can get out cracks and get into the ground and create a vapor source in an area that you weren't necessarily expecting it. But otherwise, in terms of the pipe itself being a preferential pathway because of it, you know, that could happen and you'd have to treat it as a preferential pathway.
Okay. Does anybody else have anything else to add on that one before we go to the next one? All right. Laurent, got a question for you. Is it common for warm buildings to act as a preferential pathway during cold weather in areas with permafrost?
That is a very hard question, and I cannot think of an answer at the moment, but I have someone in house.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, and I'm just going to say I'd have to think about it some more. I can help because we do have some projects in Alaska. I can ask a colleague that may have a better answer than me, but I cannot think of anything at this time.
The only thing I throw out there is that the warm building itself, the heat stack effect, would be a driving mechanism, but we wouldn't call that a preferential pathway. And I haven't dealt with, but I've read about sites in Alaska where in permafrost where as you would think, when it's frozen, you don't get much vapor movement, but when it thaws in warmer weather, you can have a problem. But as Lawrence said, there's people that specialize in that.
And I remember also an issue coming up because they have a particular type of construction to prevent some to maintain some heat at the foundation. And we start to get into fairly counterintuitive mechanism. And if you want to get at the bottom of this, please reach out and I can put you in touch with someone who studied this in-house.
Okay. So Eric, I think this is your question. When APUs are deployed, when and how should indoor air sampling occur to determine if they can be removed? Even if mitigation measures are installed, it can be difficult to turn off APUs and occupied units to demonstrate the mitigation was successful, especially if TC is the primary risk.
So what I typically do is rely on about a week long waiting period after, say, a subslab system was turned on to reach a steady state. And you know, short of that, you really just kind of have to turn them off and then do your testing to show that the subslab or whatever other mitigation you've done is working. That said, the other consideration when it comes to APUs is thinking about the air exchange rate of the building and how that is going to cycle and how long it's going to take for, again, sort of steady state conditions to set up after the APU has been removed.
Okay. Thanks, Eric. I think that's all the time. Again, if we didn't get time to answer your question because there's still more in the queue, please feel free to reach out to any of our trainers and hopefully they'll be able to help you. I'll turn it back over to Devin to close us out and take us home.
Thank you, Matt. And thank you to all of our expert trainers for answering those questions. And obviously, big thank you to those participants for asking those questions. Like Matt said, you can feel free to email any of the trainers following up on any of your questions. You can find their emails in the PowerPoint slides that are posted on the CLU and website. Also, you can email ITRC's training account, which is the first bullet here, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Thank you to the trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC document. We would like to hear back from all of our participants today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that is linked on this last slide. It will also show up as the webinar closes. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated today will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. Again, if you need any clarifications, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org or training@itrcweb.org. With that, thank you all for attending. And that concludes our VIM Session 1 training for today. Have a wonderful rest of your day.